Good evening and welcome to Late Debate. I'm Katie Hannan and joining me tonight I have Fine Gael TD for Louth, Fergus O'Dowd, Fianna Fáil TD for Dublin West and Party Spokesperson on Defence, Jack Chambers, Green Party Senator for Laois Offaly and Spokesperson on Agriculture, Food, Forestry, Heritage and Animal Welfare, Pippa Hackett, Environmental Journalist John Gibbons, Agri-Food Economist Kieran Fitzgerald and Dr Neil Walker, IBEC Head of Infrastructure, Energy and Environment and Transport. Now we want to hear from you, so do get in touch and join in the conversation. You can text us on 51551, email us on latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebate_rte. Now, to kick off tonight's climate special as part of the RTE on Climate Week, we want to talk about agriculture because when it comes to greenhouse gases, agriculture is our largest emitting sector. It accounts for over a third of our total emissions. And these emissions are actually going in the wrong direction, up almost 2% last year. And this, of course, has been driven by the continuing increase in the dairy cow herd numbers. That's up 27% in the last 5 years alone. Now, if any of you watched Philip Boucher Hayes's documentary Hot Air on Tuesday night, you may have seen Billy Glasheen talking about the challenges of beef farming today.
Well, we're selling it at the base price at the moment is €3.45, and it's costing us about €5 a kilo to produce it.
All in, your fertilisers, your feeds, your diesel in your tractor.
Yeah, your variable cost, your fixed cost in your time.
Okay. That's quite a big gap, isn't it?
Yeah.
How do you make that sustainable? How do you turn it around?
Well, this is a huge issue for the future. It's not sustainable that we produce beef at below the cost production and we're destroying the planet in the process. So we have to change something.
And that was Billy Glasheen. Now, Cavan farmer Jane Shackleton also featured in the documentary and she has taken the road less travelled.
I suppose we treat the whole farm here as an ecosystem, so we're low input, we're extensive. Our stocking rate will be below the national average. We have a lot of forestry, so a quarter of the farm we have planted in forestry over the past 20 years. We have bogland and a lot of kind of wet habitat as well that we leave, that we don't drain, and hedgerows.
Comparable farm with that third extra in the size of the herd, is he making much more money than you?
I would imagine he's making less.
And that was Jane Shackleton there. Kieran, what was striking about that those two side-by-side scenarios was that Jane was making roughly the same amount as she estimated in terms of her much less intensive operation. Mm. And she was producing over Billy Glasheen, I should say, his farm, his very intensive farm, which he was running along absolute Tagusk advice lines, that was producing over twice the carbon per hectare of Jane's farm. Mm. What's wrong here? I mean, does that not raise serious questions about Tagusk and the advice they're given to farmers?
Well, I think the reality is that there are different farming models, and I don't think there is a one-size-fits-all model. If you look in detail at the Tagusk income figures, in particular, they exclude direct farm payments every year. And I think this is one of the issues we have about the overall beef industry is that it's a €2.3 billion turnover industry that in addition gets €1.3 billion in direct payments. And, you know, when people look at that, at the sector and look at the below-cost bit, there tends to be this focus on, well, there is a transaction between a meat producer, a farmer, and a factory, and out of that, there's no income. What's forgotten is the €1 billion. And if I was going to try and address then in broader terms, how can you improve income, notwithstanding our climate change challenge, and not either go to complete scale, so you have 20 farmers in the country producing the 1.6 million cattle that go off farm. We're not going to go there. What you need is a very much informed policy around the fact that for 20 years we've had below cost selling of fresh food products in supermarkets, not just in Ireland, but right across Europe.
Okay, sorry, I got to stop you now because we're focusing on the issue of sustainability, economic sustainability for beef farmers. But I suppose for the purpose of this evening discussion, let's talk about the fact that The type of the way in which he, following Chagas' advice, is producing his beef, is running his farm, is producing twice, more than twice as much carbon emissions as the less intensive farm that Jane Shackleton was running.
Sure. So there is a model of mixed farming that involves diversification. There is no doubt about that, that can have beneficial effects. And in effect, some of the barriers to diversification have been down to carbon accounting systems. I mean, there are issues around the fact that if you grow trees, the benefit from trees grown on a dairy or beef farm accrues to the industry that uses the output rather than you as a farmer. So there is that issue. But I think economic sustainability is part and parcel with the overall climate change piece, because if you are looking at a situation where the state is very likely going to look at carbon emissions from the agricultural sector in terms of taxation, because it has targets to meet, you can't impose that and impose higher compliance costs and expect the farmer to still get a price that's below cost. So you must square the whole circle in terms of price and environmental sustainability. And again, I think another piece of how we look at this is that if you look at sustainability, and you know, we are where we are in a European context, we tend to be around the middle of European grades in terms of beef, but we're at the top of European, if you like, low carbon emissions in dairy, then I think a holistic approach says, let's look at this in the context of carbon emissions. Let's look at it in terms of economic and rural impact. Let's look at it in terms of price return for producing a product that has sustainable criteria.
I wanted to pip in there. You farm. Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What kind of farming do you do?
We were suckler farmers as well, a little bit like Jane. We're organic also. We also have sheep, hens, forestry too. So diversity, if, you know, initially is this, I suppose, the first thing for our farm. I think when you look at the examples that were on the programme, and as you say, Billy is following the plan to a T, and I know many farmers like that, very intensive farmers, have followed the advice and
working incredibly hard.
Absolutely, yeah. You know,
and producing a lot of beef.
A lot of beef with a lot of animals, very intensively, you know, getting the fertilizer out bang on the right time, all of those. And in that model, unfortunately, is falling apart, and it has fallen apart and unraveled very rapidly, as we've seen. I think we have allowed for too long the lobbying power of big agribusiness to dictate what the agri-food policy should be in our country, when we really should have had farmers at the centre of policy, and family farm incomes, farmers themselves at the centre of the policy, rather than be dictated to by big agri.
But what was interesting, I thought, because we've been listening to Chagas, you know, and they're saying, if, you know, we have a plan, if we can get farmers to follow this plan, we will bring down our emissions. But then Gerry Boyle, the Chagas director, was before the PAC last week, and he said that Ireland must face up to the incompatibility of our high numbers of cattle and our environmental targets. And that, to me, was a big admission, John Gibbons.
Yeah, I'm certainly glad to hear it, because the last day that Gerry was here with us, he floated the idea, for example, that Ireland has a responsibility to feed the world. He suggested, for example, that we're feeding the equivalent of 35 million people globally. And this point was echoed by Leo Varadkar when launching the review of the Climate Action Plan last week. And Leo actually added an extra 15 million. He suggested that Ireland is feeding 50 million people globally. And if this were the case, you'd say, wow, what an amazing system. And Leo actually went further and said, we need to give a special pass. We need to consider a special pass for agriculture because of our unique role in feeding the world. Now, I've looked closely at these figures, and the UN Food and Agricultural Organization data for 2013 says that Ireland is a net food energy importer. Now, that works out to the, on average, an average Irish person, we import the food energy equivalent of 1 tonne per Irish person per annum. 1 tonne. So in fact, rather than adding to food security in the world, our intensive monocultural model, 91% of our country is now beef and dairy. This is a country perfectly capable of supporting a diverse range of agricultural options. But instead, we have doubled down on one or two intensive, industrially driven models. And as Pippa said, the people who are benefiting from the farmers who are intensifying are the guys selling them the fertilizers, the guys selling them the sprays, and the co-ops, and of course the meat factories. What the people who are missing out of all this are the farmers who are getting squeezed. And I think the example of Jane Shackleton shows there are other ways of doing this. And sometimes I think, and I hope this is a learning moment for Chagas to step back from simply ramming growth at all costs down the necks of farmers, especially when they're not the ones who are making it on their bottom line.
I know you want to go very quickly because I want to
just very quickly. The comment made by the Taoiseach is based on the fact that we produce 600,000 tons of beef. We produce 7.5 billion litres of milk. Now, at average consumption levels, that amount of beef and that amount of milk feeds 40 million people. That's the statement that's been made. And the notion that we are where we are in agriculture is purely driven by Chagas is nonsense. We had milk quotas for nearly 30 years, from 1985 to 2015. Irish farmers were constrained, and Irish farmers, when the shackles were taken off, Irish farmers grew their business and they've been very successful.
They were encouraged by Chagas to expand in that direction.
No. What happened was, for years and years, they were producing the most cost efficient dairy product in the EU, and they were subject to a 5 billion litre constraint, which was what New Zealand produced in 1984. So what has happened in dairy is actually very much the opposite of what the picture you're painting here. We have seen milk production increase to 7.5 billion. We've seen spend in the Irish economy on farm and into the rural economy increase by 2 billion euros on a yearly basis. So what's missing from this discussion is what fuels rural Ireland in terms of its economy if you clamp down on its beef and its dairy sector. I mean, there isn't any replacement. Forestry doesn't replace, for instance, beef in terms of transactions. You know, there.
Yes, that is a good conversation that has to be had. But you still have to come back to the fact that we have to bring down, and we are committed to bringing down our emissions.
We have to do it on an insightful basis. I mean, if you take the beef piece, and the Mercosur deal raised this issue hugely all year, the European Union in its magnificence had been telling everybody that climate change was its number one issue until Mercosur came along, and then its number one issue was let's do a trade deal with Brazil and import Brazilian beef, which produces five times the emissions. And throughout the summer, fires were burning in the Amazon forest, and Brazil was negligent in looking at them. So it is very much a total picture you have to take into account. And the platforms of that are what's going to drive the rural economy, how are you going to replace 100,000 jobs or so that are there in the food and agri sector, specifically linked to beef, and also what are you going to do in terms of this carbon leakage thing? Like how does the global economy, if you like, or the global climate benefit from more beef being produced in Brazil, which is highly polluting, and less in Ireland?
Okay, I just
so square the circle.
Everyone wants to come in now. I want to leave. I want to bring in Neil.
Okay. First of all, yeah, there are a lot of small farms. Pippa's colleague, Eamon Ryan, has been calling for a national plan, if you like, for land use. And actually, so has Chagask. For years, they've been saying, what's the best use for the land? Now, actually, some of the research I've seen has suggested if you move away from growing grass, it's actually quite difficult in large areas. You can't move to arable crops that easily. So the question is, if there are some low-hanging fruit, that there are more than two dozen recommendations that Chagas have for improving farm productivity and sustainability that have been adopted into the Climate Action Plan that the government has recently published. But if you want to go beyond that, are there other things that could preserve the rural communities and provide a secure income and allow a degree of diversification? Because that is envisaged in the Climate Action Plan. In the short term, it's quite difficult to see moving on. You know, farmers don't particularly want to move into forestry because once you plant a forest, it's a forest forever. And you don't see two farmers leaning over the gate talking about how the trees are growing. But you know what? There are, in the longer term, opportunities to turn grass into an energy crop. Now, there are serious sustainability issues that have to be addressed. So it would have to be done in a circular economy way, such that if you're going to anaerobically digest the silage, you then turn the digestate, what's left behind, into a highly effective organic fertilizer. So you can produce more grass and then you turn it into a renewable energy, which can be used in transport or heating.
Okay, Pippa doesn't look convinced. I'm going to come to you on that in a moment, Pippa, but I want to let our I don't think I've ever had two TDs in this studio that have been so quiet for so long, I have to say.
We're listening to the experts for once.
Jack, in terms of what Kieran was saying and what John and Pippa were saying, do we need to talk about the size? We've 7 million, more than 7 million in the national herd. Do we need to be open a conversation about whether or not that is sustainable if we want to meet the targets?
I think farmers and the whole agriculture community are open to that conversation. I think having the zero-sum game of conflict between farmers and people involved in agriculture and everybody else isn't helpful. And I think farmers can be the front line of biodiversity, of sustainability. They're the people who are out in our rural communities. But I think...
Can I put one figure to you on that front, just on that exact point? The Irish Examiner did a poll, as they always do, for the ploughing, around the time of the ploughing. And one of the questions they asked was, do you believe in climate change? 27% of farmers
of the key recommendations of
63% do.
One of the key recommendations from the Climate Action Committee has been, as part of, say, CAP reform and have education and kind of a bottom-up approach around agriculture. In France, for example, they've very good stakeholder forums to manage this transition with the agricultural community. In Ireland, we've an absence of any intervention across the layers of stakeholder involvement. It's a case of saying, we have the herd or we don't. CAP reform, the key part of CAP reform will be around the environment. From 2021 onwards, 40% of payments will be to manage reform around and managing better diversification of land use. I think farmers are willing to do that if they're paid to do so, if there's an incentive to do so. But I think this kind of top-down approach of switching off the lights will only polarise the farming community and will undermine a proper discussion about sustaining rural Ireland. And I think that's the problem sometimes with these debates. Are you for or against? I think farmers are willing to change. I think they're willing to diversify. But I think...
Is there not a problem, though? And I'm going to put this to Fergus in that, because I did speak to a lot of farmers around the country in recent months, and I'm from farming stock myself. I'm aware of the feeling in that community, and there is a strong feeling among many farmers that this debate is very unfair, that they are being placed on the front line, that they are being blamed for the climate problems of the world, and that they're not being given proper advice on how to go forward, that it's all about just being told to cut your herd or...
I think the rural communities...
Is it going to be a problem? Politically, is this a problem trying to sell this?
I think it's a perception issue, obviously, that there is a battle between people living in urban areas and people living in rural areas, and that rural communities, by their very nature, are more dispersed. Therefore, they need transport more. Carbon taxes will affect them more. And if their produce is an issue in relation to carbon consumption or carbon emissions, that is an issue for them. But I know that in my own constituency, County Loud, the IFA in County Loud have held a meeting some months ago supporting what Jack is saying here on diversification and, what is the future of farming. So farmers are very much tuned into what the needs are.
But it politically, for a party like Fine Gael, who have, we have a strong urban base. And a lot of your, you would represent maybe more of the bigger farmers, the bigger beef farmers around the country?
Whether they're big or small, the fact is that farmers...
Is it a politically difficult road for you to...
No, I don't think so. I think the messages have to be made more clearly. And we need to sustain and support rural communities. And I think the point is that one of the arguments about the beef is that there's a lot of very small farmers who have a very small number of cattle and they're not economic. Mm. Their income is deemed to be on average something like 8,000 per year and they have to get other employment. So in order to sustain and to live in disparate rural communities, particularly in remote areas, you need to keep farming and you need to have an income. And the other point I want to make, I think it's the most important point I could make, is that farmers have kept our agriculture as a prime asset for us for generations after generations. They love their land, they love their work, and they need to be respected more for that. And I think it's wrong to dump it.
There's just a tweet up here. 91% of Irish agriculture is beef and dairy. That's some statistic. Is that the case?
That's the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
But if you look at grassland, is something like 90% of our arable land. So we're very small in the cereals area. So, 91%. And I think one of the issues about that is actually grassland is a carbon sink.
So yeah, that has to be.
Well, grassland emits 6 million tons of CO2 a year, so I wouldn't call it a sink.
Oh, no, it is.
They're the actual figures.
No, sorry. The scientific study done by Pádraig Kiely in Teagasc, which showed that an average farm in Ireland sequesters 2 tonnes of carbon per hectare. Now, we happen to have 4.7 million hectares of grassland, and at 2 tonnes of carbon, that is the equivalent to 3.7 tonnes of CO2. Oh. So that's 30 million tonnes sequestered.
In the global atmosphere. Carbon accounting.
And we are working to get that recognised
reckoned by the EPA, our grasslands attribute 6 million tonnes of carbon emissions.
Okay, I want to get our farmer back into, into this, Pippa. In terms of the debate is raging. We're getting it in. I'm being accused of farmer bashing here. Oh, come on, stop bashing the farmers. On your analogy, we all should go back to our mud cabins. It's called progress. It's the way we have been educated so far. Stop bashing our culture and traditions of farming here, says Ina. Katie, you all forget that agriculture is our indigenous business and bailed out the rural communities in the collapse of the Celtic Tiger. Also, when corporation taxes increased and the multinationals pack up, what will we do? Yeah. Dublin and every city is choked with big SUVs bringing one child 1 mile or less to school. This is from Mary in Wicklow.
I think we, in a lot of these debates, we always forget about, we talk about the climate sort of emergency and climate emissions. We also forget about the biodiversity emergency that the world is, and indeed Ireland is in. And farmers are crucial in dealing with that. They are the best, and our farms are the best way of dealing with those issues. And you, even if we're listening back to how Jane Shackleton farms, I mean, she mentioned that they farm in harmony with biodiversity and the ecology, and that's what makes their farm sort of different. And I think there's huge scope here where farmers are supported to do that to a greater, much greater extent.
But for people out there who are buying the produce from farmers, does there need to be a wake-up call here and say we cannot keep managing to eat food this cheaply, basically?
Well, I think that's a fair part to it. And I think there is a genuine link between greater compliance, because to me, the way forward is likely to be, rather than meat, if you like, us stopping producing, is that there will be a demand for the equivalent of a BER rating in our food produce. It will have to pass verified carbon tests in terms of its criteria. Now, that is going to require real verification. It can't be just, you know, glossed over, and it is going to require increased costs. The quid pro quo for that is that we can't have what we have at the moment, which is all fresh products, particularly liquid milk, meat, fresh veg, turkeys at Christmas, Brussels sprouts at Christmas, sold below cost on a loss leading basis. Now, the consequence of taking away loss leading is not actually that the basket of goods goes up, is that if the supermarket wants to multi-price and mix price, they do it on other products. They don't keep, if you like, screwing the fresh food business. And I would say that what we need to think about in that context, if you like, in future thinking, is think of energy products. Like when wind power was being brought in as a means of replacing fossil fuels, the feed-in tariffs were effectively a ban on below-cost selling. So what you got was a significant price, and you got an investment because you could get a return. You will not get an investment in food, and innovation in food is hugely problematic, because at the end of the day, what ends up happening is that your product is sold below cost, and all it does is increase footfall for a supermarket. So that has to change, both in terms of economic impact and addressing the climate change.
Okay, just another couple of texts. We're getting big reaction to this debate, as you can imagine. Hi, read the farmers. One day they're being told to cut herd size, etc. The next day the country's celebrating the new Chinese beef deal. And can we export more? We can't do both. That's from Sean Curry. And another one from Robin Clare. We should be planting marijuana for all that it offers. Big time benefits. We need to move into the 21st century. John, just you were trying to get in there.
Yeah, I just really want to recap briefly on what Pippa said, because it's absolutely critical. I mean, we're right smack in the middle of a global biodiversity crash. And it's as intense in Ireland as it is in places like Brazil. In fact, even more so, because we've already lost so much of the natural world. Say, even since the 1970s, we've had a collapse, for example, in ground breeding birds. They're gone. They used to survive in the meadows. Those meadows have now been replaced by silage. Now that's an intensification and fertilizer, which is essentially pushing out competing the kind of the range, the polyculture, if you like, that used to exist in rural Ireland. Even in the time that I grew up as a kid on a farm down in Kilkenny, the bird life, the as the plough goes down the field, you watch the birds follow the plough, looking for worms and so on. You do that now. What there is in the countryside now is silence. There's few birds, even fewer insects, and even the worms are disappearing out of the soil. Now, we can talk about efficiency and we can talk about this, that and the other. If we allow our biodiversity to collapse and die in this country, there's going to be no future for farming or for anybody. And we really need to keep our heads up and to focus on this and not to get caught up in the minutiae and details about this price and that price. We and the key people here to be custodians of biodiversity are the farming community. But they can only do that if they're receiving the correct signals and the pricing signals and the supports from Europe through the CAP, which, as Jack said, has to be reformed to make sure that the primary incentive for farmers in Ireland should be, number one, biodiversity protection, number two, sustainable and resilient food production, and number three, four and five, as you like, but one and two.
Well, I think a reasonable income, in fairness, has to be at the heart of it too.
Well, an income for farmers is crucial. And actually, it's quite ironic that this week, when we did watch the wonderful programmes on RTE, the government, which had closed, if you like, the organic farming scheme for about 3 years, up until last November, where it was open for 1 month, they let in maybe several hundred people could apply for it. They've only just found out this week 75% of those who applied for it were told, no, you're not getting the scheme. So these farmers, nearly 12 months ago, signed up to join the scheme, paid their membership fees off organic certification bodies, started the first year of their two-year conversion and are finding out now, a year later, that, sorry, no, you're not in the scheme because you're too small or you're too this or you're too that. It's absolutely apparent that the government, it was a tiny fraction, you know, it was a small number of, relatively small number of farmers, and they've said, no, a lot of you can't get into it. You know, so really, it smacks of such hypocrisy and it's an appalling indictment, really, of this government's attitude to this sort of nature-friendly farming, sure. You know, and the environment in general.
I don't have the briefing in that point that you're talking about now, but I do know that, I mean, the National Climate Plan has been published and there's been the first report on that, and there's been very significant steps taken forward by the government. And it's all very well to pick an issue, and I'm not arguing about the accuracy of it, but one. I just want to make one point. It's about, I was on a farm in Limerick and they were getting anaerobic digestion of grass and they were directly connecting into the national grid, and that was their livelihood. So it is actually possible to use grass as an energy crop, and it is being done. And I think that the point you make about biodiversity is very important and very well made. But I think the key point is that the farmers themselves, they want to keep that. Farmers are totally committed. My father, Lord rest him, he came from a very small farm in Kerry, and like his successors there, they love their farm and they live for it, and they don't make a great living at all, but they love what they do. They live for it. They want to die on their farm. They love the land, and I think that's the point, that they're out to keep and preserve, and to make a living as well. But like, not to, they're not out to destroy the environment. They're out to protect it.
We need to find.
They have to live. What's interesting in the government. In the government's climate action plan, it's actually absent on biodiversity. It's still handled by another department, from Joseph Madigan's department, which is a huge flaw in terms of structurally combining both climate action and the biodiversity crisis. I think state bodies like Caolte and Bord na Mona, their mandate should be completely reversed. They should become climate leaders around biodiversity. Yeah. And I think that will give a great future to the Midlands and other areas, so that instead of being carbon emitters, that would actually will be there to reverse the crisis and promote biodiversity. But the fact that the government's plan is absent on biodiversity is regressive and short-sighted. And I think it's too siloed in the present department of arts, culture and the Gwent.
Well,
that's
don't know
where
who,
it is.
I think you're the guys that set up that department and look, the bodies. I'm not complaining about that. The bodies are
You have had it now for quite some time.
I'm not complaining. I'm just making the point that if you're under the auspices of a particular department, that's where you are. But you're quite right about the policy
It should be part of climate action.
Of course it should.
It's not.
Well, let's make it part of climate. I would support that.
But I think just an overall point I think that came out is you aren't going to address this issue by compartmentalisation. So there is no point in just looking at price on its own or looking at climate change on its own or biodiversity. It has to be holistic. Now, easier said than done, there needs to be joined up thinking. But you do have to look at the balances between Ireland's rural economy impact and the fact that agriculture and food accounts for 300,000 jobs in this country and about one third of all the spending by industry in the Irish economy. And that, as you know, without going down the route of we're going to lose all the multinationals, there are threats to the Irish economy posed by the fact that corporation taxes are under pressure. Therefore, we need a balanced economy. So we need to balance the economics piece with the climate piece. And out of that, providing we spend the incentives properly on the verification of the authenticity of our food products, I think there is growth. There is a balanced approach which meets that.
Okay. I do want to move on. Just the last few texts and tweets on this. Katie, farmers are being paid to cut down hedge grows, one of our last bastions of biodiversity. What a joke. That's from Tom. Are farmers still being paid?
What there is, you see, is there's a misunderstanding. It's not clear in when you're getting your, say, CAP direct payment. You are paid for your hedgerow, but if it infiltrates or grows into the field, then you're not paid for your hedgerow. So farmers are essentially incentivised to keep little boxy hedges because they'll definitely know they haven't got rid of their hedges, but they're nice and neat and nice and tight, and they'll get paid for that area. That's a whole area that could be easily opened up. Just let them grow.
Absolutely. I love farming and a supporter of the government, but farmers need to cop on that there is no money in beef and milk. They need to look at growing different crops, wind, solar and anaerobic digesters. But the government needs to open up schemes to support with feed and tariffs. That's from Damien and Cavan. The power rests with the consumer, says Cathy, not the farmer. As long as we opt for cheap, intensively farmed meat, dairy, etc., the farmers will keep prioritising maximum production over the protection of biodiversity. And we will leave it there. We could go on here for another 3 hours on this, I'm sure. But I want to move on to transport, because transport is, again, another big ticket item in our emissions. Emissions up again last year, fifth time in the last 6 years that transport emissions were up. And we are now at 137% of our 1990 levels. I'll go to you first on this one, Neil. We saw the Climate Action Plan, a huge emphasis on going electric, on electric, on EVs, basically.
Yes.
Many would say, including some senior civil service, according to recent reports in the Sunday Times, that the 1 million target for EVs is, you know, just pie in the sky. It can't be reached.
If you look at where renewable energy and greenhouse gas reduction has been happening in the transport sector, it's actually been kind of almost invisible. Biofuel obligation scheme, particularly for liquid biofuels, has been going up year on year on year. Now, there are technical limits, because if you're blending, you get to a certain level and it's not stable. So there will have to be new kinds of fuels. And electric vehicles certainly offer a big opportunity. That said, 1 million does seem an awful lot. I mean, by
2030, I should say. Yeah.
Yeah, because the last time this had a target for 200,000, they ended up with maybe 5,000. So the cost of batteries is coming down. But if you look at the upfront cost, it looks very expensive compared with an internal combustion engine vehicle. But if you look over the life cycle, you know, it's lower maintenance costs, it's lower running costs. So if you can take that longer view, it's actually competitive now. So how can we persuade people, you know, innovative financing or whatever, that you see it's actually not an expensive option?
But it's not so much the expense, I think. It's this range anxiety that people want. John, you drive an electric car.
I do indeed. And I bought it about a year and a half ago, and so far so good. I think it's one of those things, once you get your head around it, that you do have to plan your day a little bit more. If you're using public transport, you're always thinking about schedules and so on. We've just gotten so used to the idea that you just step out of your house, step into your car and go anywhere in Ireland and back, as if it's just our right. Now, maybe I don't think it's such a big thing to have to actually think a little bit about a plan our journeys and so on. And from my point of view, to be able to get rid of the gas guzzler, to move to an electric vehicle, which I charge it overnight at home, which means the national grid, I think we're running at about 60% wind and much of the time overnight, which means this is really and truly running on the most natural energy imaginable.
Is there not an issue with the batteries though, and the what's going into the batteries? And, you know, how sustainable that is and how environmentally friendly that is.
I suppose you could say that about anything. I mean, it's that old saying about if you want to make omelettes, you're going to break eggs, right? This is the case. I mean, I've never really heard people say, you know, internal combustion engines use all these resources and isn't it terrible, right? I mean, we're talking about...
We all appreciate and agree that it probably isn't that great in terms of carbon and everything. But, I mean, we are taught to believe that EVs are... clean and the way to go. But if there are issues there that we're just brushing over because it's inconvenient.
I mean, there's mining, extraction, there's metal, there's moving parts in it. Of course there are. I mean, that pretty much goes without saying. And I, for example, don't believe, I certainly, to re-echo what Neil said, I don't think for a second there's any prospect of being a million EVs in the road. Not only that, I don't think we need a million EVs in the road. We are faced in a situation where we need to figure out how to decarbonize every sector of the Irish economy. Now, we've just talked about agriculture. We see how tough that is. We've just said that transport emissions have gone up 137% in 30 years. Now, how are we going to head towards 95% decarbonisation of this economy with the same paradigm, which is large vehicles, irrespective of what they're propelled with, whether it's electric, it's better. Of course, it's better than fossil fuels imported from God knows where. Of course it is. But what we need, and I think this has been reflected in the Jocka report, is a modal shift where we put public transport, high quality, interconnected public transport, number one, backed up with cycle lanes. We need to rethink our cities. Mm. We need to push the private car, whether it's electric or anything else, out of our cities.
Fergus, can I just say, in relation to that, I think I've said it in this studio before, I noticed that in the Climate Action Plan, there was a lovely picture of cyclists on the front of the transport section. but little or nothing in the actual plan to deal with the huge issues that cyclists have.
I think the point is the government is expending $8.6 billion in 2040 plan on public transport. And in fact, just on your cycle paths, the bus connect is 230 kilometres of dedicated... Sorry, you mightn't like this, I didn't interrupt anybody. I think it's important to make this point. If you don't want to hear it, you can leave. The cycle paths are 200 kilometres new dedicated cycle paths. My leg is sore, but it's not as sore as your head. It's not as sore as your head. Queen of Fall doesn't like to hear the truth.
I think if you follow the debate around, particularly the cycling issue,
hold on a second.
There is huge anger among cyclists out there that they're not getting the infrastructure they need.
That's not true. Because Michael Ring is supporting greenways up and down the country.
We're talking about Dublin.
Do you want to listen to the facts or do you want to keep interrupting me? I want to be very clear that there's 8.6 billion. You have Metrolink, you have Bus Connect, you have Dart expansion. You're talking about huge transport. You're going to increase the number of people travelling by Dublin bus from 140 million a year to 210 million. You're going to be carrying 50 million people a year on Metrolink. And I repeat, you will have dedicated, separated cycle lanes of 200 kilometres in Dublin by 2027 if the Bus Connect gets through. That's the proposal.
See, this is the problem, Fergus.
That's the fact. It's not a problem.
Look, can I speak? I think was it a classic example actually was the cabinet bought 200 diesel dirty buses and then bought a couple of green buses and decided to have their meeting about the climate action plan around that, and that kind of symbolises this government when it comes to climate action and transport.
Rubbish.
The ambition to get about electric vehicles in 2030, 2040 we're going to have this great radical change, but when you look at what's happening right now, things are quite static. When you look at, for example, with electric vehicles, the amount of charging points is being only slowly rolled out.
Yeah, no, you're right,
Bus
yeah.
Connects, we had experts, the Climate Action Committee, that actually criticised Bus Connects because it didn't develop those concentric community cycle lanes that are required to encourage cycling
that's
within communities.
No,
that's a fact, because if you look at Bus Connects, it's a linear pattern that actually that doesn't provide the level of segregation that's required. If you look at the examples in London and elsewhere, Bus Connects doesn't match, and also doesn't integrate public transport and an active transport
plan. Segregated cycle lanes.
It has some segregation, but not enough.
But and it's,
we're not empowering local authorities to actually develop. No, you're not. The other problem with Project Ireland 2040 is it hasn't been climate proofed. I mean, it was a plan published prior to the Climate Action Plan. So the fact that the whole capital infrastructure and spending is going on a plan that was published prior to the government's own Climate Action Plan is a whole contradiction of policy. We should be front-loading decarbonized projects right now. So we should be purchasing electric buses.
After you bought
200 diesel buses, people need to see climate action on their rail system, on their bus system.
Okay, Jack. I want to let Neil in. In relation to this, we've just got a text in here. Make all public transport free. It'll cost less than the fines for not reaching climate targets. That's a tweet, actually.
Yeah.
Good Neil. Idea.
I think Bus Connects is one of the most brilliant initiatives in years. Yeah. I mean, just take Dublin, for example. But, I mean, Bus Connects is a nationwide thing. We need it in Galway, we need it in Cork.
Yeah.
But overall, we desperately need it in Dublin. Now, the issue of cycle lanes on dedicated separate things, those are for what they call the core corridors. And they are actually likely to be the most controversial, the most difficult to get through planning. Everyone who comes into Dublin has seen ribbons tied around trees. Communities are worried about losing their gardens or mature trees being cut down. And that's why there's going to be a second round of consultation. But the NTA is onto the right track. There are two things needed. Firstly, a more sensible network. So at the moment, we have routes that have been around for decades and they're no longer fit for purpose.
Why? If you want, they connect communities. Is that not fit for purpose?
Well,
but they'd be more efficient.
I live in the village north of Swords. If I wanted to get from Swords to somewhere like Blanchardstown or Liffey Valley, it's very hard to do it without going into the centre of the city.
Yeah.
And there's maybe five buses.
But you won't be able to get to Swords under the present Bus Connects plan. I read the plan. There's no connection between Blanchardstown and Swords. There's no urban
metro,
route proposed.
The metro link
so
is
it doesn't do what you're talking
the
about.
Connect. They're all connected.
There's no metro to Blanchardstown.
No, but they are all being connected. In other words,
the buses. Metro West.
No, but the buses.
Project Ireland 2040.
I'm sorry, the buses are connected to the metro.
There's no connection.
Let Neil finish his point.
I support orbital routes, but there isn't one in what he's talking about. There isn't a connection.
There's no politics in this. This was developed by the NTA with the assistance of Jarrett Walker. It's an international consultant. The first iteration needed quite a bit of tweaking. So the routes have now been tweaked and the core corridors will be consulted again in the new year. And IBEC is 100% behind Bus Connects. We want the business community to get behind this because it's not a prediction that the city is going to be gridlocked. It is gridlocked.
What about the business community in Blanchardstown where all the buses will be removed from it? How will people who want to use kind of peripheral suburban towns, would IBEC support the removal of buses from Blanchardstown Village?
We had 266 million.
But that's an example. I mean,
I think we might be getting a little granular in terms of that particular part of the debate. Pippa, you've been trying to get in.
Yeah, I think it's great to have. We're having this discussion about public transport, you know, but at the end of the day, the government still chooses to invest in road infrastructure ahead of public transport.
That's not true.
Well, it is true.
No, it's not true. You're
and
wrong.
In, well, excuse me, I've just come up. I drove up here, unfortunately, three days ago, and it took me nearly 2 hours, even on the expanded M7 three-carriage motorway, 24 kilometres from city centre, it said it'll take me an hour. It was gridlock, and that was not even at rush hour. So, I mean, and we're talking about expanding the M11 motorway up from the south.
Is we it's are going spending to be exact, more but it's going, on public transport than we are on roads. That's a fact.
And you don't acknowledge that, and the Green Party should.
Listen, but the road expansion is continuing at a huge rate.
But it's 5.7
And I'm not talking about resurfacing rural roads. I live in rural Ireland, and plenty of things. Huge big investments that are
like RB.
And where are all these cars going to end up when they drive into the city of Dublin? Because that's pretty much where they're all headed.
Yeah, but the point is that we are spending a lot more, almost 2 to 1, on public transport. Secondly, the question of the roads that are in the National Roads Plan are bypasses of places like Gardaí that are chock-a-block with lorries and foul emissions day in, day out.
The M7 expansion wasn't a bypass, that was there already, by having bypasses, two lanes to three lanes.
Essential bypasses of towns like Gardaí, you improve the health of everybody, you get to work easier, children aren't polluting and swallowing all those down gases, and you have your proper bypass of the urban
area. Sorry to interrupt you there, Fergus. I have to take a break, but stay with us because we want to talk about energy after these.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. And I want to turn now very quickly to energy. There was a significant 11.7% drop in emissions from the energy sector last year. But this decline was largely due to issues at Moneypoint, which saw a significant drop off in coal-fired electricity generation in 2018. At the same time, electricity generated from wind increased by 14%, putting the average annual share of electricity coming from renewables at 32.6%. Pippa, is this a good news story for?
I think it's moving in the right direction. I actually quite think that's quite interesting about when Moneypoint wasn't working properly. It was a huge drop in terms of our emissions. Then you know it's sort of a very obvious thing to not return to use in a way at full capacity anyway. I live actually in Offaly, very much in the heartlands of Bord na Mona land, you know, and we've very much seen how that part of energy creation and generation is going to be affected over the next few years. I mean, yes, it's been accelerated, and I think the knock-on effect for the Midlands in particular is quite significant. You know, we've actually had a flood of job losses over the last number of years. So there's a real direct hit on Midlands areas as a result of decarbonising the sector. And I suppose the Green Party in particular have been really vocal about having a just transition.
Will there be a backlash against Green Party because of that? Because people will associate what has happened there with perhaps some of the policies that
I don't think so. Now, I just know from when I was canvassing for the local elections that it was a few people would mention, oh, sure, aren't you the ones who wanted us to stop? And I said, well, actually, no, it isn't. And we're actually the only ones who are actually looking after you guys or thinking about the workforce into the future. Because really, the government have been caught napping completely here. This has not been something that, you know, came out of the sky last year. We've known about this decarbonisation process for 10, 15, 20 years. And yet we still have the situation where people are losing their jobs. And then, you know, there's 80 jobs in the next 12 months. You know, there's hundreds of jobs overall are going and there's no plan in place for them.
But do you want to keep the peak burnt then?
No, I'm absolutely no. You don't. No, that's not what I'm talking about.
No, sorry, what are you talking about then? Sorry,
the job. But I'm saying
you either do or you don't.
No, but the government and
we're saying you don't burn peat anymore.
And everyone is accepting of that, including all the peat workers. They know that.
Sure, and we've got to get them alternative employment, and that's what the just transition is.
But the government should have had a just transition policy in place.
But we have now.
You have now.
We
have very last minute. Very late.
The job losses were announced. You hadn't even appointed
the commissioner. It's crisis
management from government.
You can call it whatever way you like.
But that's the reality.
Kieran Mulvey doing the job or is he not?
But
he is.
No.
So therefore, that's a fact. The fact is, and I agree with you, we have to. The reality
started last. The reality of the job losses.
Were you caught napping a bit there?
Jobs have to change, and we must find.
But we should have found this. That's why we have, obviously, it's a start.
You have 34 million in the budget this year to help in the just transition. You have 11 million for retraining. You have also money to 20 million for retrofitting homes and for retraining.
But Fergus, would you not think you shouldn't do it at all then?
Are you saying don't do it at all? Where do you start?
I want to let Neil in here on this.
But you have to start somewhere.
Yeah. I think it's important to get some foresight as to what other sectors might be put at risk as well. IBEC has been working through NESC with the other, you know, social partners, the environmental pillar and the unions, to try and identify potentially vulnerable sectors and then put plans in place for reskilling. It's all part of the future of work, lifelong learning.
So who else needs to worry?
Well, there are a number of sectors that would be deemed as carbon intensive, low margin, you know, and Brexit's certainly not going to help. So it's a matter of identifying, can you diversify? But I mean, it is an early days yet.
Are you going to tell us which are the vulnerable sectors?
No.
This is going to be your secret, Neil.
It's my colleagues.
Very hard to retrain people.
My colleagues are working through NESC, and in due course, NESC will be publishing.
Sure.
John.
Yeah, I think the piece we've known about, the need to withdraw from peat destruction for a long, long time. So let's accept that. Let's do it properly. Let's move on. We are sitting on the best consistent wind speeds in Western Europe by some distance. Mm. We have the potential to be a major energy exporter. At the moment, 6.5 billion euros leaves this country every year in fossil fuel imports. We could, with enough ambition, in theory, connected to a full European grid. We've seen a little bit of this with the recent interconnector directly to France, by the way. Let's skip Brexit and let's do more interconnection to France. Put us on the European grid. And when you're part of a wider European grid, there is an endless market for clean, renewable energy. Mm. We have the best resources. If we're going to be in multinationals...
But if there is an Innes, can I ask you in relation to the wind issue? Because I spoke to the former minister in that department in relation to this, in relation to the new guidelines that are coming out in relation to how far away from a turbine you need to be and all of that.
Offshore,
and his view is that we are at capacity onshore now.
I agree. Let's go offshore. We've ample opportunity. We've already done this, by the way, on the Arklow Bank. That's on the East Coast. We've opportunities to go offshore on the West Coast.
Again, the problem I fully agree with John. I think we need to absolutely accelerate our offshore potential.
And be ambitious.
And also solar and microgeneration and community. But the problem is the government has failed completely to provide a regulatory or legislative framework in terms of offshore. There's total uncertainty. Is it another plan that they're trying to talk about in 2025, 2030? What we need now urgently is a regulatory framework where people can invest and go offshore so that we can provide that export potential. But the problem is the government has a lack of ambition around this trajectory.
That's not true.
Could front load this investment with this focus right now and provide really ambitious export-led energy sector. Yes. There's huge potential here.
Okay, clean
energy. I just think one of the issues that this brings up again is this need for long-term planning and connectivity. And we shouldn't be in a situation where we've a clear signal for 10 years about peat and we're now looking at retraining. And I get it. I mean, what you're saying, I think, Fergal, is that you guys actually did something. A lot of other governments before did nothing. And you're being criticised for acting. But there is a joined up piece needed around energy because as a food industry, we have a huge comparative advantage actually in grass-based production. When it comes to processing that and particularly drying milk, we pay among the highest prices in Europe. So there are competitiveness issues and sustainability issues. What we need though is signals that send that are based on long-term commitments. And if you look at Ireland, one of the things we have been successful in is we've had the same corporation tax policy for nearly 40 years. We need to look at long-term price signals and policies across other sectors like energy. Make a commitment to a long-term.
Absolutely. Okay, I have to take another ad break here, but stay with us.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Okay, we just have a minute left. Neil, very, very quickly, you wanted to make one point there.
Yeah, certainly we've made incredible strides in renewable electricity and there is scope for more. I mean, the 70% targets are fantastic, but don't forget that electricity is only 20% of our energy. We've got to have renewable heating and energy efficiency. Mm. You cannot save the world just with electricity. It's important, but it's only part of
the
picture.
Neil, we can convert many of our other systems, our energy systems and our transport systems can actually be converted to the electricity that we can produce. We need to be much more ambitious.
Mm. Okay, and we need to finish up. I want to thank my panel. Just time for one headline there from the Irish Examiner. It's leading with
a story by Mick Clifford. GSOC to probe judge's text to woman. Woman says she's unable to find a solicitor willing to represent her. And they have the Maria Bailey Swingate TD dropped from election ticket there as well. And that's all we have time for. Tonight's programme was produced by Brian Lally. Research was by A.B. Philbin Bowman. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon, and Harry Bucklis was on sound. And now it's over to Cathal Murray on Late Date.